From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A new adaptation of The Graduate is in previews on Broadway and opens April 4th. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with three people behind the 1967 film The Graduate, the screenwriter Buck Henry, the director Mike Nichols, and the star Dustin Hoffman. Robert Redford will be given an honorary award at the Oscars on Sunday. We'll feature a conversation with him. And film critic John Powers reviews Y Tu Mamá También. It's about two teenage boys in Mexico City. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A jury in Portland, Oregon, has ordered Philip Morris to pay $150 million in punitive damages to the family of a woman who died from lung cancer. Lawyers for the estate of Michelle Schwartz said the tobacco company misled her into thinking that she was protecting her health by switching to its low-tar Merit brand. Schwartz died 3 years ago at the age of 53. Attorneys for Philip Morris said Schwartz, who was trained as a nurse and married to a doctor, knew the dangers of cigarettes and chose to smoke anyway. President Bush has told a gathering of world leaders in Monterrey, Mexico, that economic, legal, and government reforms are critical steps for developing nations hoping to reduce poverty. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Monterrey.
The president is promising to increase the amount of aid the U.S. gives to developing nations by 50% over the next 3 years. After that, he said, the total will grow to an annual increase of $5 billion over current levels. But he also said his administration will tie aid to progress poor nations make in putting significant reforms in place.
The goal of our development aid will be for nations to grow and prosper beyond the need for any aid. When nations adopt reforms, each dollar of aid attracts $2 of private investments.
The president's speech was also in part a response to criticism here that the U.S. should contribute even more than the administration has promised. Don Gagne, NPR News, with the president in Monterrey, Mexico.
The Bush administration announced new tariffs on Canadian lumber today, charging that Canada unfairly subsidizes its logging companies and lumber exporters. The tariffs would add an average of 29% to Canadian softwood lumber, the kind that's most widely used in house construction. Attorneys for John Walker Lynn, the American captured with the Taliban in Afghanistan, are fighting to see some of the government evidence against their client. The defense wants access to 33 documents under review by the federal judge in the case. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Lynn's attorneys say their client was wounded, exhausted, and in a state of shock when taken into custody last December. Over the next month, he was interrogated, first by military intelligence officials and then by the FBI. During that time, Lynn's lawyers say he asked more than once for an attorney, but was told none was available. Lynn later waived his right to an attorney, but the defense says he only did so to receive better treatment. Lynn's lawyers want to see a series of documents the government has filed under seal that they believe may have information about their client's condition that give a more sympathetic portrayal than what the government has released. Prosecutors say the documents should be kept sealed because they deal with how the government is preparing its case. A hearing on what government documents will be made available to Lynn is scheduled for April 1st. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 52 points today to close at 10,427. This is NPR News. The State Department is warning Americans to leave Pakistan because of the danger of further terrorist attacks. Non-essential workers and dependents at the U.S. Embassy are being ordered home as well. The warnings follow this week's grenade attack that killed 5 people at a church in Islamabad. The Pentagon announced today that it's set to begin another round of flight testing for the V-22 Osprey aircraft. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The V-22 Osprey aircraft has been plagued by maintenance problems and a bad safety record. Its revolutionary design may be part of the problem. The aircraft can take off like a helicopter, but its huge rotors then tilt forward and it can fly like an airplane. The Osprey was developed for the Marines, and they see it as an ideal aircraft to ferry forces in and out of hard-to-reach places, but it can be hard to control in some situations. Last year, the Pentagon decided to scale back production of the aircraft and put it through a tougher testing program. The new testing is now set to begin next month. Undersecretary of Defense Pete Aldridge said the Pentagon would consider an alternative to the V-22 if the problems with the aircraft cannot be worked out. Aldridge said the new flight tests will continue for 2 years. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
A Florida doctor was sentenced to more than 60 years in prison today after being convicted of manslaughter in the drug overdose deaths of 4 of his patients. The judge in the case acknowledged that his order amounted to a life sentence for 55-year-old Dr. James Graves. Prosecutors say Graves prescribed OxyContin to patients who were addicted to it. Graves said his patients falsely told him they were experiencing pain to get the drug. In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 17 points to close at 1,851. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
It's been about 34 years since that depressing advice was offered in the film The Graduate. Now, a Broadway adaptation of The Graduate, starring Kathleen Turner and Alicia Silverstone, is in previews and opens in less than 2 weeks. The show has already broken a record. It has the highest advance sales for a play in Broadway history. On today's Fresh Air, we're going to hear from three people behind the film, The Graduate, starting with the star, Dustin Hoffman. The Graduate was one of the first films to depict the alienation young people felt from their parents' generation in the 60s. Hoffman played a college graduate who's returned to his parents' upper-middle-class suburban home. He's lost. He has no idea what to do with his life, although he knows his future isn't in plastics. One night after a party thrown by his parents in his honor, he's recruited to drive home Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. Mrs. Robinson, played in the film by Anne Bancroft, convinces a reluctant Benjamin to come into the house. She puts on some mood music and gives him a drink.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't... I mean, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Well, he guessed right, and she succeeds. But after they've started their affair, he falls in love with Mrs. Robinson's daughter. In 1999, Hoffman talked about the director of The Graduate when I asked him to tell me who gave him the best advice on acting in movies.
Probably Mike Nichols in The Graduate, who told me almost every day two things. Three things. One was stop acting. Don't do...
I thought he meant get a new career. Well, he just
sure
meant tone it down, right.
He probably thought that. Uh-huh. But he would say, you're acting, don't act, don't do anything, because you are doing so much in front of a camera by not doing what you think is anything. I mean, you're on whatever it is, 70 feet of screen. You're already interesting. And the audience is doing a lot of the work for you, even. I mean, you don't have to do their work for them. And he said, if I did something he didn't like, he'd said, what did you do that take? And I would tell him, and he would say, why? And I would tell him the reason. And he would look at me, he says, oh, I get it. Okay, on this next take, when you get an idea in the middle of the scene, do the opposite. And that was really a smart thing to say. And then the third thing he did 5 or 6 times a day was tell me to clean the inside of my nose, which
is actually the most helpful,
which has kept me on the marquee for giving all this long.
Now, is that important? Hasn't a good take ever been ruined by an embarrassing you know what in your nose?
Yes, but now with digital, they can just it's costly,
really,
but they can take a lot of boogers out that they couldn't do.
Dissenhofen, 1968 was the year of The Graduate, and because of that movie, I think you were probably seen in part as a representative of your generation. And I was wondering what that experience was like for you.
You know, I was 29 going on 30, and I have a, when you mentioned that, I have a fixed memory of going to some, being invited to some college, because actually I went from an unemployed actor, actually someone on the unemployment line, to doing The Graduate, and suddenly I'm thrust into stardom, and the next thing I know is I'm supporting McCarthy for president and flying around the country with one of his daughters in a little airplane to all these colleges, trying to, you know, get votes for Eugene McCarthy, from an unemployment line to that in a few months. And I remember being in a college somewhere in the country and the kids kind of having this glaze in their eye of, oh, the new icon has arrived. And I systematically set out to kind of dethrone myself. and I said, guys, I just played a part. I'm an actor, and I'm not your age. I'm 30 years old, and that's just a guy I played, and it really has very little to do with me. I just wanted to be this actor, and I really wanted to avert the curse of being called a star.
Dustin Hoffman recorded in 1999. Last year, when I spoke with Mike Nichols about his HBO adaptation of the play Wit, we ended with a question about The Graduate. Nichols won an Academy Award for directing the film. I asked him about the most famous shot from the film The Graduate. The scene that this is from is the scene in which Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft, is trying to seduce the young Dustin Hoffman, freshly out of college. And the shot that I'm referring to is just as he's saying, Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me? She has been sitting on a bar stool. She's wearing a fairly short skirt. And as if in answer to that question, she has like raised her legs a little bit and separated them. She's like bent one of her legs. And you shoot Dustin Hoffman through her spread legs, through that one bent leg. And that shot even became the shot used, or the image used, in the ad campaign.
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about coming up with that shot?
Well, it was all about, that scene was all about him being stalked by Mrs. Robinson, you know, and we talked about it being a jungle, and it was a jungle. There was all these plants in the Beverly Hills garden that was, you know, behind the glass that surrounded this sun porch, and we talked about her being the tiger in the jungle, and she had a striped dress on, and tiger striped dress on, and it was all built to be a trap, a tender trap, and then I wanted to just to find a way to express the fact that she was being extremely provocative, and that he was framed by that provocativeness, and that it was making him sweat. And there was her leg, and it was up, and it seemed logical, you know, to shoot through the arch of that leg.
And did you try it many different ways before coming up with just the right shot?
No, we just did that one shot. I mean, there it was. Anne put her heel up on the bar stool, and there was this very nice little arch through which you could see Dustin very well. And I said, oh, good, let's come over here. I like this. So, you know, things that become famous in movies are a concatenation of so many things that are out of control that have to do with the theme and with the way the theme strikes a time and a moment and people in their unconscious, all sorts of things that we don't control. But the process of choosing the pieces, the beads for the necklace that eventually gets thrown into the flames on the funeral pyre or that gets put on the princess as she's made into the queen, the process of making the beads, to try to abandon this metaphor as quickly as possible, is always the same. You know, you just look for the shot that most clearly expresses what's happening.
Mike Nichols recorded last year. The Broadway adaptation of The Graduate opens April 4th. We'll talk with Buck Henry about writing the screenplay for The Graduate after a break. This is Fresh Air. The Broadway adaptation of The Graduate is in previews and opens April 4th. The screenplay for the 1967 film The Graduate was written by Buck Henry, who adapted it from the novel of the same name. Henry also co-wrote the TV spy spoof Get Smart, wrote the screenplays for Candy, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and used to be a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. I spoke with him at the Film Forum in Manhattan in 1997 after a 30th anniversary screening of The Graduate. I asked him about the last scene in the film. After Dustin Hoffman is seduced by Mrs. Robinson, he falls in love with her daughter, Elaine. But Elaine is about to be married. At the end of the film, Hoffman barges into the wedding and runs off with Elaine. They make their getaway on a bus. But after a few moments of triumph and exhilaration, they're staring blankly into space. Well, let's start with the end of the film. In the end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop and this, like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole, it looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Because the movie's so open-ended, it leaves itself really open to a sequel, which you actually pitched in the movie The Player. And we actually have that scene here, the beginning of Robert Altman's movie The Player, set in Hollywood. And at the beginning of the movie, you know, throughout the movie, everybody's making their pitches to the big producer, played by Tim Robbins. Here's Buck Henry as himself in The Player.
Okay, here it is. The Graduate, part two.
Oh, good.
Now listen, the three principals are still with us. Uh-huh. Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, Catherine Ross. Mm-hmm. 25 years later, and so are the characters. Ben, Elaine, and Mrs. Robinson. Ben and Elaine are married, still. They live in a big old spooky house up in Northern California somewhere. And Mrs. Robinson lives with them.
Mm.
Her aging mother, who's had a stroke.
Mrs. Robinson has a stroke,
so she can't talk.
It's going to be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
With
dark
a stroke?
And weird and funny and with a stroke.
Okay.
Maybe it's not a stroke. Maybe it's, I don't know what
anyway,
it is.
Go on.
It's a malady of some sort.
Okay.
She's up there in the bedroom upstairs listening to everything that happens. They've got a daughter who's just graduated
from college. That's good. Young blood.
22, 23-year-old, like a Julia Roberts.
Right.
Excuse me.
Right.
What did you let me do with these scripts?
That goes to Bonnie Chereau.
Okay.
And find out from studio security how Adam Simon got on the lot. I want to know.
Adam Simon? Okay.
Okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Julia Roberts comes
home. Julia Roberts
their
comes
daughter,
home.
The graduate.
Yes,
and she's
the new graduate.
The new graduate.
The postgraduate.
Okay, Griffin loved it. He just wanted me to run it by you.
Thank you.
So did you ever try pitching that one for real?
That was my real pitch. no, I thought it was, obviously I meant it to be a kind of parody of what people really do in studios. But that didn't stop after the opening night screening of The Player. It didn't stop a producer at a studio from stopping me in the outside of, by the popcorn and saying, you know, that was really amusing. But nevertheless, don't you think we can do something with that? It seems very practical somehow with the actors all being alive. I had to admit that's true. It is practical. It's hell to use dead actors. So It's been pitched a number of times over the years.
Did you pitch it to studios, or did they pitch it to you?
No, I've never. I think it's a totally crazy idea.
So you've turned down all requests.
Yeah.
What are some of the crazier pitches you've got?
For this?
Yeah.
They always say, you know, just carry on with the story, like
whatever that means.
Yeah, it's easy to do. So I thought we did about, I think it was 8 or 10 takes of The Player, and each time the pitch changed a little since it was all being improvised, and it got loonier and loonier. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel became characters at one point.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me. Now,
they're two very different things, sleeping,
yeah,
you know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
Uncomfortable segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
The most famous line in The Graduate is the line where one of the father's friends says, I've just got one word for you, one word, plastics. That line struck a chord. I mean, it seemed to just kind of sum up everything that was false, you know, that people didn't want their lives, their futures to be part of.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. It doesn't, you wonder why it took me more than 10 seconds, if indeed it did. I worried about plastics for a while and even talked to Mike about, are we too old-fashioned with plastics, which was sort of a 50s, 60s way of complaining about society's falseness. But I couldn't ever think of anything that was as interesting or more interesting, and or anything that wasn't a better word for them to say. Plastics is such a nice word. And the guy was so good who did it. The best thing about that was a few years later, I was watching television and I saw the scene come up, the party scene, except the actor didn't quite look like Dustin and the actress sitting in the living room didn't quite look like Anne, but it was every shot all the way through plastics to the end of that piece and then the same photography and then why not try the Peace Corps? And the Peace Corps had done an ad perfectly parodying the movie. I wish I had it. It was really a good piece of work.
Buck Henry wrote the screenplay for the 1967 film The Graduate. Our interview was recorded at the Film Forum in Manhattan in 1997 after a 30th anniversary screening of the film. The Broadway adaptation of The Graduate opens April 4th. We'll hear more from Buck Henry in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's another scene from The Graduate.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
You sign the register, please. Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
Where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Hannah's Gift, Lessons from a Life Fully Lived by Maria Husden, a memoir of life lessons taught to a mother by her daughter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
Coming up, more with Buck Henry about writing the screenplay for The Graduate. Also, Robert Redford, he'll receive an honorary award at the Oscars on Sunday. And film critic John Powers reviews Y Tu Mama Tambien.
That was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People people talking without speaking.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Broadway adaptation of The Graduate opens April 4th. Let's get back to our discussion with Buck Henry, who wrote the screenplay for the 1967 film The Graduate. The film is based on the book of the same name. Our interview was recorded in 1997 at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a 30th anniversary screening of The Graduate.
Now, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot I listened to it a bit while working. He thought, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
You'd think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and you know, there was never anything that could replace it. Finally, I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker. And you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called? The Strawberries?
The Lemonheads.
Lemonhead. Yeah. Well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. Ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen kids. And of course that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was, it's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, you know, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. It was so interesting. So then we rationalized it because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long, we had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller. And this is a long distance from that?
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's
and,
wonderful.
And nobody ever, I mean, there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah. And
now, the funny thing is, like I read, she was in her 30s, I think about 36 when making the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, although he's playing 20 years old, was really 29. So that would mean their ages are, what, 7 or 8 years apart, which, I mean, lots of people have relationships with people 7 or 8 years apart. It's and
yeah, but you have to buy him as being 21.
As being younger, right. But did they have to do anything to make him look younger and her look older so that they'd seem far apart, even though they weren't really?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, Dustin, well, you know, all male actors play younger than they are, inevitably. And I think Dustin is buyable as being 21. I was amazed when I found out he was 30. I had some experience of Dustin in the theater. He worked in a theater I was playing in the early 60s, and then in the mid-60s, I went to this performance of a Ronald Rabe play called Harry Noonan Knight, a really strange and interesting play in which Dustin played, in which I saw this guy, I didn't recognize him, playing one of the three lead parts. He was playing a crippled German transvestite, and by the middle of the first act, I knew I was seeing a really weird theatrical thing because I realized that the producer had gone out and hired a crippled German transvestite to play this part. The accent was perfect. The limp was spectacular. And his transvestitism was completely convincing. So I'd seen Dustin do really amazing at least one amazing piece of work, but I didn't know until I saw him do the test that he could do this too.
Buck Henry wrote the screenplay for the 1967 film The Graduate. Our interview was recorded in 1997 at the Film Forum in New York. The Broadway adaptation of The Graduate is in previews and opens April 4th.
Kids, coo-coo-ca-choo, this
Coming up, a conversation with Robert Redford. He receives an honorary Oscar on Sunday. This is Fresh Air. It's always seemed like a paradox. Movie star Robert Redford is also the founder of the Sundance Film Festival, the world's biggest showcase for independent film. Robert Redford will receive an honorary award at the Oscar ceremony on Sunday. The citation will read, "Robert Redford, actor, director, producer, creator of Sundance, inspiration to independent filmmakers everywhere." Redford won an Oscar in 1980 for his directorial debut, Ordinary People. Since making his acting debut in 1962, he's appeared in more than 35 films, including Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Way We Were, All the President's Men, and The Sting. We called him in his editing room back in 1998. He told me that when he was a teenager, growing up in Southern California, listening to jazz, especially West Coast jazz, was an important part of his life.
There were places that existed then that were really wonderful. There was a place in Long Beach, right on the sand, called Howard Rumsfeld's Lighthouse. And then there was the place that I used to go to, and the only way I could get in there, I was taken there by an older woman who was 20, and I was just 15. I was 15, of course, I was riding high because I was not only going in illegally, but I was going in with an older woman, which made me feel like really big stuff. And we went to a place called The Hague. It was a tiny little kind of a dive, looked like a sunken foundation in this big lawn across from the Ambassador Hotel. And I remember her taking me in there in 1952, I guess it was, 53. And it was just tiny, as big as a living room. And there was Mulligan and Baker and these other guys, and they were just coming out with a sound that was so different, and it just went through me. It just went right through me. I was just transfixed. And so I hooked into something that was just starting. And I think that association gave me, you know, added to my passion about it, because I felt that I was part of something new. And the same with the beat poetry. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know who any of these people were. Kenneth Rex Roth and Michael McClure and Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg. I just remember the guys made a lot of noise, you know, and I thought I was going into a jazz place, and instead it was City Lights in San Francisco.
The bookstore.
Yeah, and Ferlinghetti's place, and so I didn't know what was going on. I just stumbled in there looking for jazz and was about to leave because I thought, oh, wrong. And then there was this stuff going on that was just different, and you could feel it. You know, you can feel it when you're in the presence of something new, a new voice, a new idea, and it becomes a real hook. So I stayed and was very, very taken with it, because for me it was somehow, I mean, I was not a, I guess I was more quite a maverick kid. I was not drawn to convention, and I was bothered by the conventions I was forced to live in a kind of Republican environment in Southern California where everything was perfect, the sun always shone, and there was something missing for me that I found in these two movements.
Sundance is, of course, named after your character in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, your 1969 film. What was the impact of that film on your life and on your career?
Before that, I had a certain freedom that I lost. You know, there's a danger, I think, if you're conscious, if you're paying attention, that with a kind of success that you begin to be treated like an object. And maybe some people want that. Maybe that's the end game for some people. But it wasn't for me, because it was going to deprive me of the ability to observe. If I was being observed as an object, then it was less likely I was going to be able to look back and see somebody in a real way. And that would be a danger. And then you move to the next stage of that, which is you begin to behave like one, because you have no recourse. I mean, if you surround yourself with too much protection to guard against the assault from the outside that is full of such distortion, then the danger that comes from that is you become insulated to the point of losing a sense of reality, and you begin to behave like the very thing that people are viewing you as. And then the third, I think, and final death knell is you become one. So that was always something that I was on guard against, and kind of moved through my life wary of it, you know, tried to avoid ever getting sucked into that place. But I think that particular film put me into a new place that was extremely difficult in the beginning, because I had a lot of balancing to do and I had a lot of soul searching to do, and it was a struggle for a while.
What was the soul searching about? That might be too personal, in which case, don't
how
answer
honest
it.
You were going to be with it, how really honest you were going to be with it. You mm-hmm. know, a lot of people like to be falsely humble and say, oh, I don't like all this attention, I don't like this and that, and the truth is they want it desperately.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lie. And I wanted to look real hard at that. I thought, well, I've ended up in this place. Is this something I basically maybe really wanted, or did it just come on me? And I need to get in touch with that and understand what that's really about. Otherwise, I'll go way off the track. So that was where the struggle came. I had to identify what part of it I really did like and be able to be honest about it and say, this feels good, and then separate out from the part that didn't, that was going to be destructive or dangerous. And that took a while.
Did Paul Newman, who was your co-star in Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, did he give you any advice on handling this new celebrity?
Yeah, he did. He says, the best thing you could do would be to have a mind like mine, which is essentially empty.
What does that mean?
That way you'll survive forever. You know, you forget things, you forget where you are, what time it is. That's the way you survive in this business, and I've really tried to follow him. He's done a beautiful job setting an example.
So tell me why you named...
Paul had a real strong value system built in, and I saw his struggle that he was, I think, quite successful with. So in a way, Paul did set something of an example. I think it's one of the reasons we got along well, is that we both had little use for a lot of the things that other people place a high value on.
I would imagine, paradoxically, that now that you've created this really successful community at Sundance, that you might be somewhat removed from that community by virtue of being Robert Redford. You know, a lot of people come there who are new and learning their craft and trying to get established, and you're the already established star of the place. You're the creator of the place.
There's irony there, if not paradox. That's for sure. That's sort of a strange feeling. One of the nice things, I love being there when the labs are on, because by taking two elements out of the process, competition and money, you'd be amazed at what that does for the work condition. And it really is, if I do say so myself, it's really exciting to be there during the time the artists are there working, because the freedom and the camaraderie that exists, the sharing that exists, the challenging, the debates that go on are all healthy and strong and full of passion, and it's exhausting in a wonderful way. And so that, to me, was a success, that creating a community there for artists to come and work and share with each other was what I was missing in my life. And the irony is that it is not so easy to plug into, because you have people kind of staring at you with a different expression.
So in some ways you still don't have that community quite, huh?
not quite as much as I might like if I was, you know, maybe more anonymous, but that's okay. I still love it, and I get a lot from it, and that's just nature of the beast, I guess.
Since it seems like you were somewhat ambivalent about all the success that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid brought to you, why did you want to name Sundance after your character Sundance?
Well, this is weird, but I didn't. It's a
you
hard
didn't?
One to say that, because I don't think anybody believes it, but it's true. I did not want to name it Sundance. I was overruled. When I started Sundance, I had four partners, which dissolved within a year when I realized that they were really only interested in Sundance as a real estate venture, and I was interested in it as a more of a preservation project. Once they realized that I was going to resist building hotels and developing the land, I think they just freaked out and sold back their interest to me. But when it was starting and I had the four other partners and we were getting into the venture and buying this land from a sheep herder in Utah, there was the discussion of a name, and I was making the film. I was in the process of, of making Butch Cassidy at the time, and that name, which is a great name, came up. And I said, no, I love the name, because in truth, what Sundance really is a ritual. It's a Native American ritual that owes to the Plains Indians. It's a ceremonial. And there is a place called Sundance, Wyoming. And so I said, I like the name, and also you can translate it to what this place looks like when you go up to the top of the mountain, particularly in the wintertime. The sun does seem to bounce off the top of the peaks all around you in the Wasatch Range. And sun is, it's got a lot of symbolism. It makes a lot of sense in a lot of different ways, but I'm playing a character called the Sundance Kid, and I don't want to go that way, because it'll look like I'm ripping off the film just to get a name for Sundance. So I argued with the other investors, and they overruled me because the other names weren't very good, and they said that I wasn't objective and that it was stupid and it was a great name. So I gave in to that, but that was not what I wanted.
Do you remember any of the names you wanted?
Yeah, I wanted Mr. Redford's Place.
Right.
No, I can't remember now what it was, but it wasn't as good as Sundance. I have to agree that it's a very good name, and through the years now, I mean, maybe in time that film will be forgotten to the point, at least as it relates to the name.
Robert Redford recorded by phone from his editing room in 1998. On Sunday, he receives an honorary award at the Oscars. Coming up, John Powers reviews the New Mexican movie, Y Tu Mamá También. This is Fresh Air. After years of seeming to have no presence, Mexican filmmakers are coming into their own, from Amores Perros to the new Hollywood action film Blade 2. The new movie Y Tu Mamá También, a box office hit in Mexico, is gaining international attention. Our film critic John Power says this is a movie worth seeing.
I first fell in love with foreign films watching the French New Wave movies of the 1960s. They were smart and playful and political and sexy. And their sexiness didn't simply come from having ravishing actresses, although guys like Truffaut and Romer always had an eagle eye for the lookers, but from capturing the texture of how it felt to be alive at that time. Jean-Luc Godard famously dubbed a bunch of his characters the children of Marx and Coca-Cola, and that phrase helped define a whole era. Now, almost 40 years later, there's a delicious movie that thrills me in exactly the same way, while at the same time being something brand new. Y Tu Mamá También is set in Mexico, not France. It takes place in the dawning millennium, not the nostalgic past. And it offers a portrait of teenage life that's so smart, touching, and sexually liberated that it makes you embarrassed for what passes as a teen movie in Hollywood. Y Tu Mamá También, which means, and your mother too, tells the story of two cute 17-year-old Mexico dudes who we might call the children of NAFTA and marijuana. Tanak, played by Diego Luna, is the son of a rich, crooked politician. His best friend Julio, that's Gael Garcia Bernal from last year's Amores Perros, lives humbly with his single mom. Like an infinitely sweeter and more attractive Beavis and Butthead, the two think of smoking dope and getting laid as a form of principled anti-bourgeois idealism. Their wildest dreams seem to come true when they get a sexy older married woman, Luisa, that Spanish actress Maribel Verdú, to travel with them to a mythical beach known as Heaven's Mouth, for what they dream will be an orgiastic fiesta. But as the trio drives from their sprawling home city into the heart of a country that's rawer, more beautiful, and more divided than they'd ever realized, Tanak and Julio discover there's more to life than their own small conceptions had led them to believe. What starts off as a giddy adventure becomes a voyage of self-discovery for the two boys, an unhappily married woman's search for her true identity, and a portrait of a Mexico that's still caught in a kind of protracted adolescence. Without ever underlining it, this old-fashioned road movie reveals a whole culture. Its machismo, its reflexive dishonesty, its political corruption, and its crippling sense of social class. Y Tu Mamá was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who co-wrote the script with his brother Carlos. He's the flagship filmmaker of a new Mexican cinema that's breaking free from the old stereotype of Mexican movies as grim, preachy bummers. Cuarón is a world-class talent whose work for Hollywood is often super stylized. He made the kids' film A Little Princess and the updating of Great Expectations. But his work here has an easy, abundant gracefulness as it takes us into Julio and Tanakh's world. "You're so lucky to live in Mexico," Luisa cries at one point. "It breathes with life." Cuarón not only shows us their story, all the romantic jockeying between the boys and the older, wiser Luisa, but a lovely voiceover reminiscent of Jules and Jim explores the fears and longings that none of them can ever quite express out loud. And Cuarón often drifts away from the official action to show us things his characters don't see. When the three attend a posh party, his camera leaves them behind and follows the servants, reminding us of the class divisions at the heart of Mexico, divisions that in the film's quietly devastating finale catch up to Tanakh and Julio. They discover that when you're a willing, or at least an unconscious participant in a corrupt country, the corruption affects you too. Not that the movie is ever heavy. One of its great triumphs is that it tosses off its social ideas rather than hammering them home. You won't come out of the theater talking about its vision of Mexican society. You'll come out excited by the movie's exhilarating openness to life, its glorious vision of Mexico's backlands and beaches, its acknowledgement that teenagers love to get high, its sidelong glances at the decadent rich and the hardworking poor, and its honest amusement in the face of Tanakh's and Julio's randiness. Warm, wise, and thoroughly wonderful, Y Tu Mamá También is, among other things, the sexiest movie ever made about young men's overeagerness in bed.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. The characters in Y Tu Mamá También listen to the Frank Zappa song Watermelon in Easter Hay. The director likes it, too. We'll close with it. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. WHYY's executive producer of national programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by H.W. Brands, The First American, The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Poker and Racehorses, we talk with Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation, and Kevin Conley, author of Stud, about the intimate acts and big business of breeding racehorses. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.